Our next case this morning is United States v. Lewis. Mr. Jevarola.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Andre Gavarola of Latham & Watkins, and I represent Duane Lewis. Mr. Lewis requests reversal of his conviction or, in the alternative, resentencing under Booker. First, I will address the conviction. The facts of the case are simple. Two women drove up to the police and said they had a gun. The trial required only the government to prove only one element, whether Mr. Lewis held a gun in his hand on September 8, 2001. The government presented two eyewitnesses, Maliko Simpson and Shaquandra Williams. They each said that they saw Lewis holding the gun. The trial took less than one day, yet the jury took several hours and went into the next day before the jury could reach the verdict. The jury struggled to reach this verdict and was tipped over the edge only by the court's errors. The first error was when the court permitted the government to argue, without evidence, that the police were not able to apprehend Mr. Lewis the night before September 8th. This statement bore no relevance to the single element at trial, whether he had a gun on September 8th.
Isn't your challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence really just an argument that the jury made the wrong credibility determinations? In other words, is there anything in the testimony that would require a jury to find it incredible as a matter of law?
There are a few things in the testimony, Your Honor. First, the testimony of the two eyewitnesses when combined in one instance amounts to a factual impossibility. One witness believed she was driving the car the entire time at the time that the holster was handed to them, and the other witness believed that she was driving the car, they stopped, and then they switched positions, and then they continued driving on. They could not both have been driving the car at the same time. And in addition to that fact, the police found the gun inside the holster in the car. While the eyewitness testified that I tossed these in separate areas of the car, and even after specific questioning by the government, they said I never put them together. So the jury should have found this to be incredible, and the jury, I think, did have an idea that there was something wrong in the testimony. They requested during deliberations a copy of the eyewitness transcript. The court denied that request. So the jury could not have confirmed its suspicion that there was something wrong with the testimony. And instead, the jury hung its decision on the fact that, look, there was a statement at closing that Mr. Lewis was not apprehended by the police and that they were not able to apprehend him. The evidence didn't show any attempt to apprehend Mr. Lewis or any charges from the night before. There's no warrant. There's no testimony about any intent to apprehend him. What happened is that, at most, Shaquandra Williams called the police. They came to her house, and they did not apprehend Mr. Lewis. There's no evidence as to why they didn't apprehend him, and there's no evidence to any attempt and failure to apprehend him. And this error should be taken in combination with the second error, when the trial judge slipped and mentioned the length of Mr. Lewis's previous sentence. After having agreed with both parties,
is there any objection made?
There was no objection made, Your Honor. I think that both parties did not notice the slip.
Well, if the defense lawyer didn't notice the slip, why would the jurors?
Well, that's because, Your Honor, earlier the defense lawyer had stipulated to a redaction of the nature of the crime, but did not mention anything about the length of the crime. And only later did the defense lawyer say, no, no, we don't want the court to mention the length of the crime as well. So in the back of the defense lawyer's mind, he was thinking of the prior stipulation, but the jury never heard that prior stipulation, so their mind was fresh.
Wait. What do you mean stipulation? Stipulations don't cabin the authority of judges. Right? right? If the judge was doing something that you thought was harmful to the client, one would expect an objection. If what the judge was doing was so apparently insignificant that nobody noticed, why would the jurors have noticed or cared?
Well, Your Honor, it would be perhaps insignificant when taken in isolation, but combined with the other error of allowing the improper statement at closing, what you end up with is Mr. Lewis looking like a fugitive and a serious felon. When he looks like a dangerous fugitive, even when the evidence against him is contradictory and thin, a jury, after hours of deliberation, will vote to convict. And that's what we submit occurred here. And going back to that evidence, the testimony could not explain, as I said earlier, how the gun ended up in the holster. The evidence did not explain how Malika Simpson called 911 five times that day, and only on the fifth time did she mention the gun. What the evidence did show is that someone else's fingerprints were on the gun, that Lewis had no keys to the home and the locks were changed, and that Lewis had no idea a gun was in Shaquandre Williams' home. And the government does not even deny that these contradictions existed. Instead, the government contends that they are minor and natural. But we submit, Your Honor, even the trial court disagreed with that statement. The trial court stated at one point in the trial that these additional facts are central to the credibility of the whole case. And in sum, this lack of evidence was so shocking that no rational jury could have convicted without the prejudicial errors.
Could I ask you real quickly, was the use of the sawed-off shotgun included in the charging documents in Lewis's prior case, or did Mr. Lewis admit to its use at any point in the prior proceeding?
In the previous proceeding, Your Honor? I don't have the transcript of the previous proceeding, but with respect to the sentencing judge at this conviction, he reviewed only affidavits from that case and did not state any objection by Mr. Lewis in his sentencing memorandum that Mr. Lewis admitted to the gun or that it was in the charging document. He reviewed only affidavits from the case. And turning to Mr. Lewis's sentence, as you mentioned, Your Honor, the district court applied a crime of violence finding after reviewing affidavits from the previous trial and seeing these affidavits said Mr. Lewis used a sawed-off shotgun in a prior robbery. And the court concluded, without consulting the statutory elements of a robbery in Indiana, that these affidavits show that the previous conduct presented a serious risk of a potential injury to others and thus applied the crime of violence sentence increase. And this is not a mere fact of conviction. The trial court did not base its decision on a review of the charging documents or the elements of the prior offense.
Now, I may have missed it. What fact did the district judge find by a preponderance as opposed to a legal characterization of admitted facts?
He found that the affidavits were credible in indicating that Mr. Lewis held a sawed-off shotgun while committing a prior robbery. And to me, this is similar to...
No, I'm lost. Why is that even salient?
Because that is
the... Supreme Court has said in Taylor, and it reiterated in Shepard just a couple weeks ago, that the judge is limited to the face of the charging documents. You can't consider affidavits.
Right.
So is it your position that there was... This would be not a Booker problem, but a violation of the basic rules about how you characterize the priors?
I agree, Your Honor, that this is a problem under Booker and under Shepard, and that...
And was a Shepard-ish... I don't know whether that's the right word. A Shepard-like argument made in the district court, or do we have a plain error problem here, too?
No Shepard argument was presented, Your Honor, because Shepard hadn't come down at that time. And
Mr. Shepard made the argument even before Shepard came down.
Right, but Mr. Lewis did object to the prior court's finding of a crime of violence based on the sawed-off shotgun. He did not name Shepard or Apprendi, but he did make the specific objection to that factual finding. And that's why we submit that de novo is applicable. But even under the plain error standard, we think the sentence should be vacated. And applying the plain error standard under Booker, we submit that the court should remand to the district court under Palladino and ask the following question.
Well, no. Look, if there was a problem that the district judge relied on stuff he wasn't supposed to rely on, we don't make a Palladino remand. We would remand because there was an error. Right? Palladino is reserved for cases where the judge has found facts that the Sixth Amendment doesn't allow him to. This doesn't, as you've now characterized the argument, it's not a Sixth Amendment argument. It's an argument about not following the basic law of Taylor and Shepard. I mean, as Shepard said, and it was all by the Bookerites, all of these statutory issues are antecedent to the constitutional argument. So let me just make sure I understand you. Do you want a real remand to eliminate reliance on anything other than the face of the charging papers? Or are you arguing just for a Palladino-ish Booker remand?
We submit that the first would be preferable, Your Honor. We think that there should be remand.
Yeah, all right. Because my understanding of Palladino is that it applies, first we ask whether there was a guideline error. Mm-hmm. We get to Palladino only if there was a Sixth Amendment error, no guideline error, but a Sixth Amendment error. But you've now recast this as saying that there was a real guideline-ish error.
Okay. Well, we submit two errors, Your Honor, an error under Shepard.
No, if there was no guideline error, then there was no Sixth Amendment error either, because the district court has not found any fact by a preponderance of the evidence. If the district court has found a fact by a preponderance of the evidence about the priors, then it's committed an error under Taylor, which is completely antecedent to the Sixth Amendment. We're on the same page?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And, yes, even under Shepard, Your Honor, there should be a remand
Shepard
for resentencing.
Well, Shepard merely reaffirms Taylor, so.
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. That there should be a remand with the instruction to the trial judge not to review facts beyond the statutory offense and beyond the charging document. And under this remand, we think the sentence should be vacated. And finally, Your Honor, I want to address the contention that Lewis admitted these facts during sentencing. Mr. Lewis did not admit these facts. He stated only that the records before the judge supported what the judge said. He never admitted that those facts were true. And in conclusion, Your Honors, if you don't have any questions, I would just like to state that Mr. Lewis has now been in prison for almost 42 months pursuant to his erroneous sentence and to contradictory evidence. And we think that it's time to let him go. Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Deverell. Ms. Nome.
May it please the Court, Tina Nome for the United States of America. Let me go to that last issue, the Blakely issue. Our argument is that this is a legal determination, and that's specifically accepted. And I think Shepard...
Let's start with the affidavit.
All right.
Did the district judge rely on any facts beyond the face of the charging papers?
My position is no, because the affidavit is part of the charging papers. Now, I did listen to what you said, and I have read Shepard.
Have you read Shepard?
I have read Shepard. That was a police report.
An affidavit attached to the charging papers is not part of the charging papers.
Well, in Indiana it is because let's bypass the constitutional argument, Judge, and go right to what we've all overlooked, and that is robbery by itself is an enumerated per se crime of violence.
Yeah, well, it may well be that the charging papers themselves would support a characterization as a crime of violence.
Well, it was a class.
Then one wonders why anybody was relying on affidavits.
Well, because we were looking at underrepresenting or overrepresenting his criminal history. So we were looking in terms of the conduct underlying some of his prior convictions to determine whether or not his criminal history was overrepresented or underrepresented, and in determining the proper range that he was supposed to get. So the affidavit was there. Now, I'm sorry.
You see, Judge Lee properly recognized that in determining whether a prior conviction consists a crime of violence, his inquiry was limited to the face of the charging document and the statutory definition of the offense.
Correct.
But here's what's difficult to determine. It's difficult to determine if he then respected those limits, because what he did was he relied on affidavits in the case that indicated that Lewis used this sawed-off shotgun in the robbery, and he relied on Lewis's statement at the sentencing hearing conceding that the records before the court supported the fact that he used a sawed-off shotgun in the commission of the robbery. So it's impossible to tell whether the affidavits referred to by the court were part of the charging document, and that Lewis's concession wasn't that he used a sawed-off shotgun, but that the records before the court indicate that he did.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think I'm drawing a distinction because in Indiana, you're charged by way of information. It's not an indictment. So there's no determination of probable cause in that information unless there's an affidavit attached to it. The problem in Shepherd, what they were trying to keep away was the court from looking at things that were not part of the record. And in Indiana...
No. That's why I asked whether you had read Shepherd. There is no doubt whatsoever that the material relied on in Shepherd was part of the record.
It was police reports.
And it had been made part of the record.
The court
you don't
record?
Want to argue with me about
All right,
this.
I don't want to. You're right. That's absolutely correct.
Or me.
But in any event... In either way, the way... even if you were to remand it, the district court... could still simply, I mean, there's no need for a remand because robbery is a per se crime of violence. So even if Judge Lee just looked at...
Which leads to my question, why the district judge was relying on this stuff and why you're arguing it? It's all, on your view, utterly irrelevant.
Well, it is utterly irrelevant. The constitutional issue is kind of an interesting issue, but it was an obvious. It was something so obvious that I overlooked it because I was interested in going down that path.
Taylor is not a constitutional issue. The limitations placed by Taylor and Shepherd on what evidence may be considered have nothing to do with the Sixth Amendment.
Absolutely not. I agree.
They have to do with the correct understanding of the statutes and the guidelines.
Which is why we argue there was no Blakely, Booker, or Sixth Amendment violation. You're shaking your head, Judge.
I'm here for the duration.
All right.
You argue.
Well, with respect to the first, I guess one of the other things I want to bring up then is, and I wasn't able to cite to Rule 28J, but I did read this case last night in my hotel room, United States of America versus Freddie Rosas, R-O-S-A-S, which was decided March 24th of 2005. And I think that the individual was making the same type of argument that Mr. Lewis is, arguing that it was the nature, not the mere existence of the conviction that required the jury determination. So along your lines, Judge Easterbrook, that would support your position that this is not a Blakely implication. With respect to the first issue, what counsel wants you to do is to reweigh the credibility determinations, which is clearly within the jury's province. You have found in several other opinions that it's not incredible as a matter of law if there are inconsistencies in witnesses' testimony. In this case, you have individuals who have minor inconsistencies, but you have to look at the whole scheme of things. This was a domestic situation, an individual with a gun. The women confronted this individual and were able to get the gun away from him and put it in the car. Unfortunately, they all end up going in the car for a ride around the block. But there's nothing physically impossible about the evidence. The jury heard it, the arguments were all made, and the jury made their determination. And I don't believe that there's anything about that evidence that is physically impossible or incredible as a matter of law. Also, there was nothing, no error in the closing argument. I do not believe that there was anything that was argued that was not supported by the record in this case.
Well at a minimum, don't we need to remand the case under Palladino to determine if the district court, you know, would have sentenced him differently had the court realized that the guidelines were were not mandatory?
I don't believe so, because there's no Blakely-Booker violation, and that's what Palladino, I believe, was premised on, because there was no Sixth Amendment violation made by the court, because it is a legal determination as to whether or not this particular crime is a crime of violence, then I don't believe that there's a remand necessary under that line of cases. I also don't believe that the district court violated the term of the prior stipulation. You know, one of the interesting things is, I know we speak in terms of felony, and we understand that they have to have a felony conviction, but the statute reads in terms of has been convicted of a crime more than 1 year. And so the 10 years is not prejudicial to Mr. Lewis. It simply lets the jury know that, in fact, he's been convicted of a crime more than 1 year. And in addition... Well, in this case, though,
doesn't it boil down to common sense?
Well, that and that
more
the judge
than
didn't...
More 1 year or 10 years?
But how does the jury know if you don't tell them? If you just tell a jury that it's a felony, do they understand that? I mean, we understand that.
You think we really ought to be going around saying that the judge ought to be saying, you know, this fella here, he was in prison for... 10 years.
Well, the nature of the
recoil.
The nature of the conviction comes out, which is what Old Chief was designed to prevent. So you don't have the drug conviction or the, you know, whatever the crime is that is so prejudicial. But I don't believe that in this case.
At least it wasn't that he had been convicted of murder.
No.
Escaped from prison and committed his new crime while on escape status. I mean, one could imagine really prejudicial things coming out.
Absolutely. And in this case, he stipulated to it. I mean, that's what made it so confusing. He stipulated to the 10 years. He was perfectly happy with it. But then he thought, oh, well.
He stipulated to the 10 years.
He stipulated that his conviction, he was sentenced to a 10-year term of incarceration for the prior conviction.
And you think he expected that to be broadcast to the world?
Well, yeah, it was a stipulation that was going to be read to the jury. How did he not? He signed off on it. His lawyer signed off on it, as well as the government.
His lawyer.
Well, in any event, it wasn't read to the jury during the presentation of the evidence, nor was it read at the time of the jury instruction, so there was no error. If you have no further questions, it is our position that the case does not need to be remanded. We believe that it should be affirmed, and the conviction should be affirmed as well.
Thank you, Ms. Nomad. Anything further, Mr. Gavirola?
Just a couple points, Your Honor.
First, Your Honor, regarding the stipulation was retracted, or at least modified, shortly after it was entered. Mr. Lewis requested that they additionally remove the 10-year sentence, so he did not, at the time it was mentioned, stipulate that the 10-year sentence should be open to the jury. And also, just regarding the Indiana statute, it's broadly worded and does not require as a necessary element the use of force or the threat of use of force or serious potential for bodily injury. For example, you could be convicted of a Class B felony.
Hardly required under 16B. In fact, we've held that theft from a person is automatically a crime of violence. So if you go up and engage in a purse snatching, for example, that's automatically a crime of violence under our precedent. How would it be possible, given that, for robbery not to be a crime of violence?
Well, under the Indiana statute as written, Your Honor, there could be, as crime of violence is defined in the sentencing guidelines, there could be a potential for a Class B robbery that does not meet either of the two elements of a crime of violence under the sentencing guidelines.
How would you have robbery that was not from a person? Under the Indiana statute?
Well, for example, Your Honor, the three elements for...
Steal a dog's chain? Would that be robbery? Stealing
sure.
from a dog?
If it was an emerald chain.
Pardon?
Maybe if it was an emerald chain. You see these spoiled pooches.
Well, Your Honor, you could, under the Indiana statute, walk up to a person and say, give me your money. And as long as you put that person in fear,
yes. That's kind of a superset of theft from a person. My question was, would Indiana classify as robbery theft from an animal? Right, a horse is wearing a particularly fancy saddle. You walk up to the horse and steal the saddle. Would that be robbery under Indiana law?
Well, Your Honor, a horse can't own property, so I don't think you could rob the horse. But presumably if the owner is there, you might be robbing that owner if the owner is standing nearby.
Yeah, well, but that's the problem. That's the thing that led us to say that theft from a person is automatically a crime of violence. Because if the owner is standing there, there may be an altercation between the thief and the owner. It was the same rationale on which Taylor held that burglary is a crime of violence. Most burglars are quite stealthy and get away, but if you invade somebody's house, you might meet the owner, who would take it amiss. Okay, thank you, Mr. Javarola.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You don't have to answer this, but I'm sitting here and wondering if the horse had been the heir of someone's estate, what would happen? I'm going to go back and research all of this.
Thank you, Mr. Javarola. If you want to file any further briefs on theft from horses in Indiana, you should feel free to. But thanks very much for taking the appointment in this case. We'll hear now the argument on